Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Steve Potter. Welcome to St. Louis Public Radio's Community Room for a conversation with Dave Holmes.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. This is really something. This is like a "This Is Your Life" kind of a situation. I'm very much enjoying it.
This
so
can't
far.
Be that new for you.
What do you mean?
I mean, sitting here talking?
Well, I mean, I sit and talk for a living, for sure, but it not normally in front of, you know, a ton of relatives and old friends and people I haven't seen.
And
in
some
a very
strangers,
long time.
Too, I think.
And some strangers, maybe, sure.
You know, I think we all have a musical soundtrack to our lives, you know,
sure.
Certain songs that we associate with a certain place and time in our lives. Well, our guest today is no different from the rest of us, only he kind of wrote a book around all that. And the new book is Party of One, a memoir in 21 songs. And he grew up here in St. Louis. He later became a VJ on mm-hmm. MTV
yeah.
and achieved fame and fortune, in his words, almost.
Right.
So
yeah.
How close did you come?
I was fame and fortune adjacent, I guess. And in fact, barely that. Like I was just a face on basic cable for a little while, it's a great job if you can get it. But it's sort of everything that's weird about living the life of a famous person with none of the wealth or access or privilege or anything like that.
Oh,
it's just,
what it is
occasionally, like once a day, someone just pointing at you.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that a lot, but for different reasons.
Sure. Yeah. No, but I bet you have a voice that people recognize. I bet when
well,
you're
Well, I'm also on cable TV, so I know the exact same
feeling.
Well,
there you go.
Right.
There you go.
So I kind of relate to you about
yeah.
that. What were the years you were on MTV?
98 to 2002.
Uh-huh. And I was an MTV person like earlier on, I guess around 1981, 1982,
sure.
83. Was
the
it
dawn.
In the dawn
yeah.
of MTV.
That sounds like I'm calling
it. Was it in its heyday sort of when you were on?
It was in like a later heyday. It was kind of in its last heyday. It was the last moment before like social media and the internet fractured our culture. You know,
mm-hmm.
like at the time we didn't have cell phones. I mean, we had cell phones, but we didn't have iPhones. We didn't have social media. We didn't have Facebook. Like now you kind of have your own station at all times. You can cater news and culture to your specific needs and you don't have to know about anything that's going on around it.
Right.
I didn't coin the term, but I call it the monoculture. Like it used to be, there was just one massive stream where all culture came through and you just got it. Everybody knew Michael Jackson. Everybody knew Van Halen. Later, everybody knew NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys. Now there's almost nobody that everybody knows.
Yeah, you know, you talk about that in your book, and I think people of a certain age maybe don't understand, but I remember when all there was on TV were the three networks, and some of them went off at midnight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of them. Yeah, you'd hear the national anthem, and
right.
that was that. And it was still, like, it's weird to me, but there was more daring stuff going on when there were three networks than there is now that there are 500.
How can that be?
I don't know. But I mean, you couldn't get Laugh-In off the ground now. You know what I mean? It would have to be focus grouped and tested and all that. Like there was legitimately, David Letterman did weird stuff when there were three networks,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he was one of two talk shows.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird to me. Now they're 18 and they're all doing exactly the same
thing.
Think
about all those choices we have, not just in television stations to watch, but social media and everything. Is it too
right.
much for you?
It is. Well, I mean, it's kind of just enough for me because, like everyone else, I've catered it to exactly what I want it to be. Like, I can be on Twitter and I can make my little jokes and I can, you know, I can sort of follow who I want to follow on Facebook and all that. So, like, I've figured out a way to make it work exactly for me, just as everyone else has. But I think what we've lost is the greater perspective outside of ourselves.
I'm just curious how you ever got there to do the MTV thing to begin with. I know mm-hmm. you were, I think you were working in advertising originally. That was your career, right?
I was slugging it out, but doing terribly.
Yeah,
doing terribly. In
it
the
didn't go well, or you didn't like it, or
both. And I kind of did my thing, and I had a realization where I'm like, I'm living in New York. I'm 25 or 26 years old, however old I was. It's very hard to live in New York. It's very expensive to live in New York.
Right.
It's like it's a hard life all the time. So one favor that you can do yourself if you're going to live that hard life is do something that you really love, which I wasn't doing. And I didn't really know how to do that, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Like I knew that I wanted to be I wanted to be on stage, I wanted to be on camera, I wanted to talk about the things that I'm passionate about, I wanted to write, I wanted to do all those things, but I hadn't thought like that's a viable career path for me ever.
Mm-hmm.
So I just sort of took a weird chance and stood in line and auditioned. And
they had this some kind of contest for amateurs,
well,
right?
They did, yeah, which I read it as like open call. It's an open call, so I'll just go. It's like a dumb chance that I should take. And what I didn't know is that it was going to be televised live over the course of several days, which it was. I also didn't know that I was going to like make it as far as I did and lose on live television in front of millions of teenagers. But that's what worked out. And it ended up, you know, it came around for me.
Well, why don't we sample some of your musical experience, I guess.
Okay.
I'll put it that way.
I thought you had like video clips of me. Which
no,
I was
no.
going to get up and walk out.
We're going to save those for later. That's another
okay.
show. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll tell you about this song. This is Silly Love Songs from Wings, which is one of the first songs I ever remember hearing on WABC in New York in the family station wagon when we lived in New Jersey. And it was like Wings. Wings I actually knew before I knew the Beatles, because I'm kind of in that generation where I was born just as the Beatles were ending and Wings were starting. And and I remember when this song would come on, everyone would sing along with it. And it was, my brothers are so much older than I am. And it was the only thing that we could really do together that I could do like with my family was sing along to the radio.
Well, you so have two older brothers, and I think the youngest one would be about 8 years older than
you.
Yeah,
exactly. So, today. Yeah.
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 Family station wagon in New Jersey?
Yeah. Yeah. Listening to whoever was on WABC.
Where in New Jersey?
Edison.
I lived in Middletown. I don't know if that
Did
was close
you?
Or not. Yes.
I was two, so I have
Went
no idea what you're talking
school.
About.
Okay.
but that's nice. I like New Jersey. I have a lot of relatives still there.
You know, it's true, isn't it? Talk about this just a little bit, the role that music really plays in our lives. What I was saying before,
right.
how we associate things with it, how we identify with it, how we, I don't know, how it just sort of helps us get through things.
Yeah. It's often like we allow musicians and you know, people on stage in theaters and people on screens and movies and TV shows to do our emoting for us. You know what I mean? When we don't feel comfortable doing it ourselves, we like farm out our emotions to people who perform. You know what I mean? It's like it's a safe way to allow yourself to feel heartsick or to feel sad or angry or happy or whatever. It's you know, you kind of you subcontract your emotions to musicians.
Well, and you talk a lot about that music in your book. Why, you say a memoir in 21 songs.
Yeah.
Why, what's special about 21?
It was, there were 20 and then I remembered something. like that's honestly what happened. I knew that I wanted to structure it like a mixtape or a playlist that I would make for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It came about because I had a column in Vulture, which is New York Magazine's like pop culture website. And they would like, I was their sort of nostalgia guy. 90s nostalgia is kind of at a fever pitch now. So they like sort of hired me to, you know, talk about the 90s and, you know, here's the top 40 from this week in, you know, 1992 or 1988 or whatever. And so I would do that and I would here and there just sort of sneak in little autobiographical tidbits and like little moments from my life and whatever, really only to see whether my editor was paying attention, because I kind of thought like, there's no way, this is not like, nobody cares about my life. They just kind of want to, you know, hear something from Salt and Peppa or whatever, right? So, but I would put them in and they stayed in, and those ended up being the things that readers kind of connected to and commented the most about. And so while writing a book was always in the back of my mind, that column kind of planted the seed for, okay, maybe what it is a playlist. And it's, you know, it's the last 40 years of music, or what I consider to be the best of the last 40 years of music, but also like, that gives you the spine that the rest of the story hangs on.
Well, if you thought that nobody cared about your life, why'd you write a book about it?
Ego, I guess. and just, you know, I don't know. It just like, I like it. Like, I like, you know, I like writing out my memories. You know, I want to get them out on
it's
paper
like therapy,
before they go.
Right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's like therapy in that it makes you feel better, but also it helps you like identify the patterns of your life. You know, like you notice the things you keep coming back around to, you notice the words you keep using, you notice like the overall pattern, as you would with a therapist, you notice what the patterns are. And then once you see them all, once they're all laid out, and once you have to, as I just had to, read the actual thing out loud cover to cover for the audiobook.
Wow.
You realize like, okay, this is, you know, I know the kind of things that I need to move. That, like, leave in the past and move forward.
Yeah, you talk a lot. You talk a lot about that in your book. In fact, there's one place where you talk about making a mixtape to sort of, I guess, subconsciously or secretly telling someone what you think, but you don't really tell them you mean what's in the song. But if they listen to the songs, they'll figure it out.
Exactly. You let Lisa Loeb do it for you. You know what I mean? That was a popular favorite of mine.
Yeah. Talk about that.
There's a moment in the book where I get just good and dumped for the first time in my life, and it happened right at the exact moment, and only certain people in the audience will know this. But there was a song from Lisa Loeb called "Stay" that's just the most earnest, plaintive, heartbreaking song, and I listened to it for about 5 weeks and nothing else, It's kind of tattooed on my brain.
How far back can you remember music being a part in your life? How young were you? What's some of the first music you remember?
Well, Wings. I mean, I don't not remember music. Like it's the first thing that I remember, really. Like Wings, Bruce Springsteen, the original cast recording of Annie. Whatever sort of variety, whoever was the musical guest on Saturday Night Live, which I would sneak out of bed and watch. I don't remember a time when I wasn't plugged in some way.
Well, I hope the audience will participate while you're here. I know they want to. And we're going to start with Michael.
Hello, Michael.
He's from St. Louis, and he has a question about growing up in the Midwest as a gay man and about pop culture. So, Michael, what's your question?
Basically it.
That's all right. Yeah,
so I'm curious. Thank you for being here. I appreciate
it. Yeah.
During your adolescence, what pop culture connected most directly with your own experience as a young gay man growing up in the Midwest?
It's crazy how much like gay subtext. I mean, we could really call it text, basically. Like it was so overt in the early 80s, but somehow we didn't catch it. I mean, there really was like Culture Club and Annie Lennox and Lost Boys. Oh my God.
Right.
Top Gun.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of homoeroticism, and there was a lot of just sort of like, you know, gay subtext going on. And we sort of subconsciously, myself and a lot of the guys that I grew up with who ended up being gay as well, kind of connected to it in ways that we couldn't quite put into words. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But having that experience was a very different thing in the 1980s and a very different thing in the Midwest because you grow up with a strong sense of your difference in a time when and a place where it's not okay to be different. Mm-hmm. You know, it's... Like, it's not, you know, you're not being beaten. It's not like you're, you know, in some, like, abusive church or whatever. But it's just you kind of told in subtle ways lies about yourself. And that you're never going to be, like, it's you don't have the option to be good or to be virtuous or to be valuable or whatever. So you get those messages. And it's like you kind of can't talk about them with anybody. So, you know, you turn to Duran Duran. You know what I mean?
Thank you very much. Appreciate
Tease the pain. Yeah. Sure. Thanks.
Yeah,
thank
you for the question. There's a place in your book you talk about feeling love for someone, but then feeling ashamed. So then you feel bad for love. I can't remember exactly how you put it.
Yeah, I can't either. But it's when you first, like when you're a young gay kid, especially when it's like kind of frowned upon, you when you start to feel feelings of love or attraction or whatever for somebody else, you immediately feel panic about it, and then you immediately try to convince yourself that it's not happening, and you feel like shame, and then you feel anger because you're ashamed, and it's like it's this weird like maze of emotions that you put yourself through, and you put yourself through it at the time when you're learning how to be a person.
Right.
You know, it's your literal formative years. You are being formed, and so it's this weird like it's like a computer process that you program for yourself when you're a kid, and it takes you many, many years, like decades sometimes, to learn that that's even there, much less how to get out of it.
There's a great story I want you to tell. I think it'd give a little insight into this. There was a time, I think it was between first and second grade, and your family was sitting down to dinner at the table or something, and you were talking, and you brought up your friend Donnie?
Yeah. And I just remember thinking, like, because we weren't super close friends. There was a kid in the class, and I wanted to just be near him. He was like a charismatic boy, and I just wanted to be near him. We weren't super tight, but then at the end of first grade, I left and went to another school, and I got to thinking about the people that I would miss and my friends that I would miss, and I remember saying to my family, like, I want to see Donnie again. Like, we should have him over here, and like, you know, we'll go to the neighborhood pool or whatever. And my mother said, like, well, why? I didn't know you guys were friends. I said, we're not. He's just cute. Because that's what I thought. Like, and that's just kind of what I thought to say. And I just remember, like, nobody was mad. And it wasn't like things didn't get crazy. But I remember everything just froze. Because it was like, wait, huh? And I remember my mother saying, like, now, do you mean that he's cute, like, handsome? Or cute, like, like he's funny and he does fun things and he does cute things and that's why you say he's cute. And it was like, it was kind of clear that I was supposed to go for door number two. And so I was like, oh yeah, no, the funny things. He does funny things all the time. He's super funny. And I just remember that moment feeling like I've done something wrong. And like nobody was terrible to me. Like everybody, you know, but it just like I felt in the moment like I have crossed a line here and I don't exactly know what I did wrong, but I know that I did something wrong. And that's not a thing that I'm going to be able to do.
Well,
again.
Something that you remember from that age had to have affected you a lot, or you wouldn't
sure.
be talking about it today.
Definitely, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was your life like in St. Louis? I mean, where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school?
I grew up in De Pere.
You knew that was coming, right?
Of course, yeah. I'll just say Priory. I grew up in De Pere, went to St. Jared's for a year, and then Oak Hill. And then in seventh grade, moved off to Priory. And it was great. It was a very happy childhood. I can't say that I didn't have a very, very happy childhood. I was just very aware of the fact that I was a little bit different. And not just, you know, sexually, just in a million ways, just not a typical boy.
What do you remember about St. Louis growing up? Do you have any special places you like to go, hang out?
I was a big fan of Two Nice Guys on Manchester.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, St. Louis pizza is the first pizza I've ever had, so I will go to the mat and say that it is very good pizza. People for whom St. Louis pizza is their second or more pizza think it is garbage. And, like, I see the point. I see their point. I mean, it is...
No, I'm on your side. It's the best.
No, I mean, I get it. I see the point.
Provel Israel cheese.
Well, let's not go crazy.
Yes, it is.
It's a you know, premium cracker with some something viscous on it, and then what else?
All right, we need to take a little break here. Oh. But when I get back, I'm going to ask you about being a square peg.
Great.
So this is St. Louis on the Air.
Yay!
I'm Steve Potter. Welcome back to St. Louis on the Air before a live audience in our community room.
Woohoo!
We're talking with Dave Holmes. He's
yes.
written the book, Party of One.
That's correct.
And, you know, you're talking about your sort of like realizing who you were story.
Yeah, yeah.
Sexuality and all that stuff.
Sure.
At a young age.
Mm-hmm.
Were you ever able to talk to anybody about it?
I was kind of. I'm going to read a little something. I had a moment where I was sort of half in and half out of the closet in college, and I hadn't told the family yet. And I was sort of, you know, that last big step that you can't really come back from, I hadn't taken yet. And the summer before my senior year, so this is 1993, I was like campus social chair because I like to plan parties and book bands and stuff like that. And I was, as I say in the book, furiously sublimating my need for intimacy. So I got a lot done. And so there was a student government conference that they had that like campus leaders or whatever from all over the country went to this thing. Not yet. We should save it because it's kind of the punchline of this story.
Why don't we hear the music first?
Well, it's kind of the punchline. So do you mind if I cue them?
No, absolutely.
Great. That'd be awesome. Sorry, once a host, always a host.
Okay.
So there was a thing in Atlanta that was this very, it was the first sort of bloom of political correctness where everything was, you know, everything was about language and all that and diversity, which is great and which is important and you should learn about racism and all that. But I arrived at this diversity festival, and things went downhill real quick. I was really excited for it because it was, you know, this whole thing about like diversity and openness. And then I got the thing in the mail, and the conference was called Diversity Isn't That Special, which like references a Saturday Night Live sketch from like 8 years before. It was not okay. So All right, the registration table was directly underneath the giant Diversity Isn't That Special banner, and I signed my papers and received my room assignment as Arrested Development's People Every Day, bumped out of the ballroom's PA system. Just when I was finishing up, Debbie, a pantsuited administrator with a fanny pack and a harsh attempt at the China Phillips Jane from Melrose Place hairdo, fixed her eyes on me with a look of practiced disapproval. "Blue eyes," she sneered. "We know all about people like you. Go sit on the floor." Now, I'm more hazel, but the distinction didn't really seem important. So I went and sat on the floor next to a beefy lacrosse type in a Clemson t-shirt. "Hello," said Clemson. "Welcome to a clumsy parable about racism." "They wouldn't," I said, as a Hispanic girl from Vassar was led to a table where a group of brown-eyed people ate steak and baked potatoes. "They would. They are." And so it continued. All the brown-eyed people were shown to tables and given fancy meals, while all the blonde girls in top knots, and in the tradition of student leadership conferences, this thing was roughly 94% blonde girls in top knots, were sent to huddle on the floor and share those packets of orange crackers with peanut butter in between. Clemson and I watched blonde after blonde hit the deck and scan the room in frustration, thinking something must be the matter. Minds getting primed to be blown. A blue-eyed Janine Garofalo type from UVA plopped herself down next to us. "Racism's bad news, huh? Give me a cracker." So it goes on like that, where Debbie comes out and says, "We've just taught you a little lesson about racism," which, like, of course they have. It's the blue-eyed, brown-eyed experiment, but just done really, really badly. The top knots made a beeline for the black kids with speeds that tested the integrity of their scrunchies. "Is this what it's like for you? You guys, I am so sorry. Can I touch your hair?" Things like that. So we make a couple of friends. We go through this three-day terrible conference. We go to the Applebee's to drink our way our frustration at the end of it. And I kind of go through... I go into a little bit of a rant just about the fact that, like, no, like, I'm in a stage where I actually need some help. Like, if you're talking about diversity, talk to me, ask me some questions. Like, or if you've been through it, tell me what to do. And I was like, I'd been drinking, and I was just like, I was really rolling, and I was like, I just want somebody who's been through it to tell me what to do. And I say those words, and the doors open, and out onto the patio of this Applebee's walk the Indigo Girls. Those who don't know are like this legendary lesbian folk duo. So it was as though they had seen like a gay distress signal in the Atlanta skies and like came to like to advise me. And so I talked to one of them, and I won't read that whole thing because I've been reading forever, but they came down and they helped, and they were actually like, they were people who had been through it who were able to tell me what to do. And then the night before my book came out, I was in New York. I was staying up near Lincoln Center. My editor emailed me. He says, "Just go to Central Park Summer Stage. Don't ask any questions." I was like, all right. I go to Central Park Summer Stage. The Indigo Girls are playing. The Indigo Girls were playing for free in Central Park Summer Stage the night before my book came out. They always know exactly where to be. They have got my back at all times. So...
Well, let's take another question. Amy, okay. From St. Louis.
Hello, Amy.
We welcome her.
From
Hi.
St. Louis. Hi.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Great, great. Good. I was wondering, what band can you place from back in your day really made everything change for you?
Ooh, that's a good one.
I mean, you mentioned a lot of bands in the book.
Yeah, I do.
Which I really enjoyed.
Oh, good. Thanks.
So, but I was just wondering, was there one band that really stuck out for you to pave the way for this book?
Yeah, you know what? It's crazy because I look back and they're objectively bad, but but I loved Duran Duran, and they're not bad, but they just don't make any sense at all. And I was so into those lyrics. I loved them, and I loved the videos, and I just loved the whole. I love the way that they synthesized like music and video, and they just seemed so like so free and British, which is not a thing, but I thought that it was a thing, and. They were my everything. And now I look back and I just, it's like, I don't know why the Reflex is a lonely child who's waiting in the park. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means. That might not mean anything at all. But at the time I absolutely loved it. And I think they more than anyone kind of set me on.
Yeah. Amy, I've got a question
path.
For you.
Yes.
You know, we're talking about, I first started going out at night, you know, nightclubbing or something when I was like 24. And I used to go to the same place every Saturday and hang out with friends and dance till 3 a.m. But this is my song memory. Every night, the last song they played was Donna Summer's last Last Dance.
Yeah.
So, you know, Last Chance for Romance and the lights are coming up. I don't have to spell it out, right?
No, of course not. Absolutely. In Los Angeles, we call it the sidewalk sale.
So I'm just wondering, Amy, when you think of a song that really was important to you and you relate to on whatever level, does one jump to mind?
Jumps to mind. I have to go back to Indigo Girls.
Okay,
and
yeah.
And I'm going to look at the love of my life. And the reason why I say that is because when I was 16 years old, my husband, who was my boyfriend when I was, you know, 16,
yeah.
He made me dinner for the first time. He made me lemon chicken. And he brought it over to my parents' house. And after we had dinner, he turned on the Indigo Girls.
Yeah.
So that's what struck a chord with me when you were writing the book.
Yeah.
And he brought up the Indigo Girls because that was honestly our first song.
I think there are a lot of people's guardian angels. I really do.
Honestly. I mean, it's been 20 years.
Yeah.
We've been together.
Yeah.
And that was the first song I remember was the Indigo Girls, him making me a lemon chicken.
How was the lemon chicken?
It was actually pretty good. His mom's a really good cook, and I think she helped.
Okay, very thanks, nice. Amy.
Well done.
Appreciate that.
That was lovely.
Dave Holmes,
yes.
Your book, Party of One, starts, I think, in 1992, and the first piece of music that you mention in the book, and I'm not familiar with it, so I want to know the story, Blind Melons, No Rain?
Oh, yeah, yeah, there's a snippet.
You know that?
From, yeah. Yeah, there's a, sure. The bass player lives down the street from me now. Nice guy. It was a song from a band that kind of, you know, they were sort of a jammy, you know, sort of, if you remember the Horde tour, like Widespread Panic and Fish and, you know, bands that would play like a 20-minute guitar solo. And they were one of those bands, but they had one sort of pop song that was 3.5 minutes long called No Rain. And there was a video in which this girl in a bumblebee costume sort of tap dances around town, and she's looking, you know, she's looking for people to, she's looking for acceptance, and she never quite finds it. And then like 3/4 through the video, she, at the end of the bridge, she like opens this wrought iron gate, and there's a whole field of people who are dressed just like her, and she can finally frolic and be with her people. And I remember seeing that, and it's a very corny and obvious thing, but I just remember seeing that in my sophomore or junior year of high school and just being like, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's life. And so I've always related to the B-girl.
Tell me a little bit more about your family. I know you have got two brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Your mom and dad happen to be here today.
Yeah,
we're really glad to have them.
My brothers just came in as well.
Your parents were music lovers, and they listened to a whole different type of music, but that influenced you too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just you know, just music being in the house affects you. And it's, you know, I would always, when I'd be in the car with either of my parents, they would have, you know, one of the classic radio stations on, where you hear Frank Sinatra and Mel Torme and Rosemary Clooney.
Oh, your mother loved Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, well, yeah. Like, for real loved Frank Sinatra, yeah. Like, I think wrote a letter asking, like, offering babysitting services for Frank Jr. and Nancy. Yeah. Frank went on to be kidnapped, right? So maybe you would have done a better job. But yeah, no, a diehard Frank Sinatra fan, and every song would remind them of something. Like, you know, they would hear a song and they would be reminded of their first dance on their first date at the Admiral or whatever. And I would hear these great stories, and it was like, for some people it's smell, or for some people it's taste or whatever. But for all of us, it seems to be music.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so that's just, I can't deny my destiny.
I love the dedication in your book. It's to mom. Or to Dad, Mom, Dan, and Steve, mm-hmm. for messing me up the exact right amount.
Yes, that's correct.
So exactly, Dave, how messed up are you?
Enough to get a book finished. You know, enough to lock myself. I did a thing where I needed to jumpstart myself, because I knew that, I mean, Los Angeles is great, but if you want to get work done, good luck to you.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a million distractions. It's gorgeous every day. Everyone has weird jobs where they don't have to be in an office really ever. So it's difficult to like keep the nose to the grindstone. So I said, all right, I have work I have to do. Where can I do only work? Chicago in January. So I rented an attic apartment because I wanted to be like a Russian novelist, you know what I mean? And just like go be in an attic somewhere and grow my beard real long and just, you know, and just have at it. And I did, and it worked.
Wow.
It got out.
Speaking of your mom, there's a good story. I think it was you were home for Christmas at some point. I'm not sure when. Fill me in.
Mm.
And your mother thought it'd be a good idea for you to Go to the Mall? You were talking earlier about your experience on MTV and being almost famous.
Yeah. As I say in the book, my my small amount of fame went directly to my mother's head. And so we would, anytime we would be in a place where young people might be, and if they seemed to glance over, which there could be any number of reasons why they might want to glance over. There could be a magazine behind me that they wanted to look at or something. Yeah, who knows? But if a young person looked my way, my mother would just go, "It's him." I'm mouthing, "It's him." And like if she's at Schnucks and the bagger looks to be young and maybe a television viewer, she'll say, "Do you know Dave Holmes? I am his mother. Would you like a picture?" And it's usually a polite no thank you.
Well, I want you to sort of like prove to us how good of a VJ you were.
Oh,
and
okay.
I want you to introduce a song for us.
Oh, dear. Okay.
And then you can kind of tell me what it means to you in your life.
Okay.
But I know the Backstreet Boys was the music we're about to hear, which I think you listed as one of the 10 most important videos to you personally. So do you want to intro it?
Well, certainly. At number one, coming in directly at number one on my list of most significant videos from my time at MTV, it's the Backstreet Boys, "As Long As You Love Me." Can we? Is it? Okay, well, then let's take it again. I'm bad at that job, it turns out. Coming in directly at number one on my list of most significant videos from my tenure at MTV, the Backstreet Boys, "I Want It That Way."
Yeah.
It is "As Long As You Love Me," but this is the better known song.
We'll just go with this.
We'll go with this.
Yeah, we'll go with this.
You are.
This to me was like when I got to MTV, 3 months into my tenure, everything dropped 10 years. Like it had been about rock music and alternative music and whatever. And then the Backstreet Boys happened and NSYNC happened and Britney Spears happened and Christina Aguilera and all of these teenage pop stars who had been in the Mickey Mouse Club and were now 16 and ready to graduate to, you know, wearing a crop top or whatever. And the kids ate it up. And so the median age of our viewer dropped significantly. And it became very much a network for adolescents and like, you know, teenagers. And you know, at first it wasn't my favorite kind of music, but a couple of things happened. First of all, I mean, it's undeniably great pop music. Like, it's all Swedish, like, songwriters who work in a lab with, like, goggles and lab coats and just create perfect pop music. But then also, like, I would see little by little more and more people would come look into our studio. They would just come and stand in the middle of Broadway, which is not wise, and just look up and just to be there and to see the place where like the Backstreet Boys might have passed through a couple of weeks ago or a couple of weeks in the future. Just to be near it was so exciting for them. And like, I know that to have had that kind of access, like my first concert was Duran Duran at Kiel Opera House or something. Being that close to them was so exciting. My parents seeing Frank Sinatra at 21 when they would go to New York is so exciting. To be a part of that thing when like a kid is close to their idol and like, and they're, you know, they're 13 and the best music in the world is coming out. Like, that's just incredibly exciting. So you couldn't, even if it wasn't your favorite music, which it would inevitably become your favorite music, you would still love it just because it was so, it had such importance for our viewers, you know?
More with Dave Holmes coming up. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Steve Potter with a very special St. Louis on the Air live from the community room for a conversation with Dave Holmes. Dave has a new book out, sort of tells the story of his life, the soundtrack of his life, A Party of One. And you do say in the book, Dave, that growing up Catholic was complicated.
Yeah. It is. It's a complicated thing, right? It's you're taught, like, the first thing that you're taught about yourself is that you need to apologize. Do you know what I mean? Like you have to like there's an actual thing that you have to say in church where you're like, sorry about me, God. You know what I mean? Like you literally have to apologize to God for offending him. Like it's from the beginning, you're taught that you're, and it's good to always want to be your best self. You should always be trying to improve, but there is something inherently sort of weird about Catholicism that takes it a tiny step further where it's like, you're broken, you know? And it's, you know, it creates, I mean, I can't complain about it because it sort of, I think it kind of provided the engine that moved me forward through life. You know, that sort of constant nervousness and unsettledness can be good for a person, not everybody, but it was good in my case. I don't know. I mean, I think it was going to a Catholic college actually kind of helped because, you know,
people you're right about how frustrating that was.
It was extremely frustrating, but because of that, it was like you kind of had to make up your mind what your relationship to the church was going to be for the rest of your life. Like some people were going to remain very devout and others were going to just kind of stay culturally Catholic and you know, let the church do what the church is going to do, you know? So now I'm kind of midnight mass on Christmas Eve, and that's kind of where it is.
You also talk about sort of using music as a drug, or you say
yeah.
your drug was radio.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not just, you know, the Catholic thing, but growing up and feeling different and feeling like, you know, a bit of a square peg, it's an uncomfortable feeling for a kid to have. So for me, the balm, like the first thing I remember like listening to and just feeling like, ah, this is soothing, is Rumours, Fleetwood Mac's Rumours. I've like listened to that and it just made me feel better. Mm-hmm. It can be, I think, you know, a drug.
Yeah. At first, your parents wouldn't get cable TV. You found that
no,
very frustrating.
They would not.
Why not?
I don't know. I mean, why don't you ask them? They're right here. No, it's not. Let's not. It's a terrible idea.
I think your mom would tell me.
I'm sure she would. That's why let's not. I think it was just, you know, the idea that it was just everything was filth and it would be unregulated. Anything that was sort of not, like sort of squeaky network TV clean. Mm-hmm. Like if somebody said something sort of, you know, sort of iffy on the radio or on TV or like on, you know, Saturday Night Live or something, common and vulgar, my mother would say. So it was just like there, like anything the cable related was deemed common and vulgar. Mm-hmm. So we just couldn't do it. And then, I don't know how I wore them down, but I wore them down.
You know, I love your words, the words that you used to talk about that, about sitting there and watching MTV for what was probably hours. You said something like, what to the untrained eye looked like vegging out in front of the television was actually me silently plotting a way to crawl inside.
Yeah, yeah. And it happened. That's what's weird. The weird thing is that finally, I think I just wore the doorman down. You know what I mean? And so like they just like opened up the TV and were like, get in here.
Did you ever do anything that you were sorry for and embarrassed about or
on
as far
the
as
air?
Being, yeah.
Whew, I'm sure I must have. Yeah. I probably blanked
that
it
out.
Yeah, I probably blocked it out. I worked on shows, entire shows, sometimes for many years. That I wish I hadn't done, but that's, you know, that's okay. Work is work.
Well, you get to meet a lot of people. I know
you
that
do.
From being in this business too. Some fascinating people, and you've
yeah.
got some great stories about, you know, names that we would recognize, like
right.
Kid Rock or Paris Hilton. Or
mm-hmm.
I got to ask
none
about
of
Paris.
Which we can just, say on the air.
You can't.
I don't think so. I would rather not. Oh, I guess the way that I tell it in the book, we could maybe say. There's more to it that we can't talk about on the air, and that I couldn't put in the book. We'll get to that.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Commercial break.
Yeah.
We'll get into it. But there was Tara Reid came down to spring break in 1999, and she brought a friend with her who because she would never tell us her name. Like we would introduce ourselves to her, and she would just be like, okay. Like she just didn't care and wouldn't tell us her name. So we guessed that she was like 30-ish, but like, worn down 30, like a 30 that's done a lot of living. And so like when we referred to her, we called her Hard 30. And the two of them were there and they were just like drunk in the morning and they would come out of the hotel where we were all staying and see like our camera set up on the beach and they'd come running to us because they wanted to be on camera, but like they'd run on heels on sand and it's like, you can't, how do you not know that you can't do that? You can't do that. You'll fall down. And they would fall down and they would come to us with like sand in their mouths and like just disgusting. And so like, it was just like Tara and Hard 30, although every time somebody had a camera and wanted to take a picture of whatever was going on, Hard 30 would like hit a pose, like a runway pose. So it was like, she's been at this for a minute. So weeks later, we go back to New York. Somebody puts a copy of the New York Post down on the table of the green room, opens to page 6. There's a picture of Hard 30. It's Paris Hilton, and she's 16 years old.
Whoa.
She's just starting her career.
That's hot. Isn't that what she used to always say?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, tell me about leaving MTV. Was that your choice? Was it something you wanted to do?
Yeah, I mean, it was like, you get about 4 years, you know, and I lasted about four and a half, and I noticed like the new generation was coming in, and I noticed that I was like, my calendar was getting more and more sparse, and I couldn't, the idea of like having them call me into a room and be like, we're not going to renew your contract was like, that was a heartbreak that I couldn't fathom. So I was like, it's coming. I should be the one to do it. You know, mm-hmm. so I did like, you know, I did the thing where you like dump somebody who hasn't called you in 6 weeks. You know what I mean? So, yeah. Did one of those.
Okay, I get it. Steve has a question.
Hi,
I'm Steve H. from St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And I noticed in your book you said you have two brothers, mm-hmm. but nowhere in the book did you ever tell us which one was your favorite?
Sit down. I would tell you right now, the one who didn't do that. My book reading. Sit down.
I want to ask you about. It was back when you were still in St. Louis, and you were in high school. And someone wanted to know, by the way, earlier how you liked Priory.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah,
loved it.
Well, there was one summer though. Summer art school got your mm-hmm. attention. This was kind of an important chapter in your life.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. There was a thing on Wydown called the Mark Twain Summer Institute, which might still exist. I don't know if it does. Do you know? Or?
I have no idea.
Okay. And it was like a summer program for artsy kids, like kids who wanted to write or act or dance. There was also an economics program, which I never understood. But it was like all artsy kids. And it was like the first time, because Priory, a lot of Catholic schools tend to be really homogeneous. And like, down to the dress code, like you have to wear a coat and tie every day, and you know the hair can only be a certain length, and you can't, you know, it's very rigid. And that was like the first summer where I was like, A, doing the thing that made me happiest, and B, doing it with people where it was like the social hierarchy was based on like the weird kids, you know what I mean? Like the kids with like the groovy hair were in charge, you know, which was not a thing that I had ever seen before. Right. It was eye opening.
And you met one of the fellow students there. It was kind of a shock to you because he was everything that you couldn't be at your other school.
Yeah, there was a pretty, you know, a kid who presented very gay. I assume that he is. I don't know, but he kind of had the simply red hair, which again only people within a very narrow age group will understand. Where it's like curls, yeah, like a little bit like that, but like curls, but over one eye. And his name was Frederick, so we called him simply Fred because of the hair. And he was like he was very you know flamboyant and like. The kids who were, like, if you were effeminate at all at Priory, you did everything you could to, like, tamp it down. You were constantly policing your own behavior and like, worrying about how you come off and how you say words and, mm-hmm. and all that. But he didn't seem to have that, like, that kind of concern at all. And he was fascinating. And he was an interesting kid. And we got to be friends. And then, you know, we went back to our respective schools. And then, you know, a couple months later, we, like, my class at Priory, and I still don't understand this, went to a matinee of Steel Magnolias. At the St. Louis Rep. I don't know why. I guess we had to be exposed to women in some way. But it was one of those matinees where it's all school groups. So it was our group and then Simply Fred's group from his school. And he like ran over to say hello. And it was like, in that moment, I was like, I can't. Like, I was like, hi. Like, just totally playing it off like I barely knew him. Because it was like, you know, you can't, like, I could be a certain way in the summer. But once you get back to Priory, it's like, you better not. And I just remember, like, that's one of my few regrets in life is, like, not just being, like, giving the guy a hug and acting, you know, behaving like he was my friend, which he was, you know.
One of the songs you talk about in your book is one I'm not familiar with, so I want to know the story, and we have it, so I want to hear it.
Great.
You can talk about it. From some group called The Hold Steady?
Yeah.
Constructive Summer?
Constructive Summer, yeah. This is one of my all-time favorite songs. The Hold Steady is my current favorite band. They are, and what is super exciting about it is that they're all my age. They're all guys in their mid-40s. They didn't even start the band until their mid-30s. They were all playing in different bands and then went back and got back to their regular lives. The guy whose voice you're hearing right now became a creative writing professor. And then September 11th happened. And, like, you do kind of tend to reevaluate your life after something like that happens. And so he called a bunch of friends. And he was like, let's be in a band. Who cares if we're 35? Let's go play in a bar. And it just, they found this magical formula. They're very much like a Springsteen and the E Street Band style kind of bar band. And I find them incredibly inspiring. The lyrics draw on Catholicism and pop culture of the 70s and 80s and all kind of the same weird doubts and hopes and everything that I have. And Craig Finn, the lead singer, hosted my book release thing. I did this kind of a thing with him on the night of my book release. And I can't believe I stayed conscious through the entire thing because I'm a fanboy.
You mentioned 9/11, and in your book, Party of One, you say something about being the last person in New York to know that it happened.
Yeah, that's true. I took a red eye into New York City that got in at like 7 on the morning of the 11th. I booked a job that we were supposed to start rehearsals the afternoon of the 11th. And it was one of these things where it was like, I was on the East Coast or on the West Coast. And like, this never happens, but it happened where my agent was like, get on a red eye. And so like, I got on a red eye and I flew in and flew into Newark and I got in at like 7-ish. Mm. And I remember the whole, I mean, of course everybody remembers the day really vividly, but I was so excited. I mean, I was so lost in my own world because I was about, like, it was a Broadway show and I was going to be, you know, I was doing 8 performances and a big show on Broadway. And I just remember seeing all of these people coming in as I was leaving, and I didn't think about it at the time, but I was just, you know, I was so happy because of new opportunities that my senses were heightened, and I just remember everything. And then I went home and I because I didn't have to be at rehearsal until the middle of the afternoon, and I couldn't sleep on the red eye. I was like, okay, said goodbye to my roommates as they were leaving, and then I went to my bedroom and fell asleep, and I woke up at 1 in the afternoon, and it was like, do you watch The Walking Dead?
Actually, I have not.
Okay. Well, it starts with the hero gets shot and he goes into a coma. And when he comes out of the coma, the zombie apocalypse has happened and the entire world has changed. That's what it was like. Like, I walked upstairs to the living room and the TV was on and the towers were down and everyone was like, our door was open and my neighbors, many of whom worked down there, were like walking the hallway covered in soot. And it was just like, I had woken up into a completely different world.
Wow. You know, you talk about that, and you've been in town a few days, and I know within the last few days or so, you were a guest on a local TV show we have called STL Up Late.
Yeah.
And we've talked to Eric Christensen about that, and he's the host. And you were talking about a piece that you wrote, was it for Esquire, the Atlantic?
Yeah, Esquire.
Esquire on violence.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of let me do whatever I want, which is really nice. But yeah, I wrote a piece in the wake of Orlando talking about a little bit of what we've talked about before, where, you know, if we consider what happened in Orlando an act of terrorism, we can also consider the fact that every victim showed up at Pulse that night pre-terrorized. Like, mm-hmm. If terrorism is an act that is supposed to change someone's behavior, all of those people showed up at that club that night having been through that. Like, our culture, especially, you know, in the 80s and 90s and certainly much worse before, teaches you to police your behavior and to change your behavior and to like kind of deny who you are until you get to that safe space. And you can, even if you just start to dance or kiss somebody or whatever, you get to do the things that you want to do.
That's interesting.
Thanks.
I had a New York story that I thought was really cool. I wanted to ask you about.
By the way,
you'll have to kind of set it up for me. It's a really unusual thing happened where one time you had the same cab driver twice.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The first night that I showed up in New York.
Tell that story.
I had gotten an apartment like $700 a month and the floors were like that. So like, you literally had to hold on to the freezer when you opened the fridge so that the refrigerator wouldn't fall on you. And like, if you put a ball down, it would roll to the other end of the apartment. And I remember my first night there, I just wanted to be in the city. Like, I had my key and my job wasn't going to start. I was still in school. Like, I still had another month of school, but I had a sleeping bag and a pillow and I was just like, I just want to live in New York City. And so I like put a couple things down and I put out my hand and somebody picked me up and I was just like, take me somewhere awesome. And which, like, don't do that to a cab driver. Although this guy steered me right. He took me to a place called The Monster, in the West Village. And I went there and I met people there and I went to another place and they took me to a third place. And then I ended up at this all night club where it was like three stories and there was a slide that you would, like, they'd put you in a burlap sack and push you down a slide. I have later found out it's because everyone else at the place is on drugs and that's like why you go down a slide when you're an adult, I guess. But at the time I was just like, yay, a slide. So I went down to the bottom and I had one of those nights where you open up the door to the club and the sun is up and people are jogging and it's like a day. And I was like, I've really lived. This is New York. And I hailed a taxi and it was the same taxi driver. And he was like, what do you think? And I was like, yes, this is, I'm in. That never happened to me again. Like the 9 years I lived there, I never had.
What's next for you, Dave?
I'm Esquire is keeping me very busy, which I really like. I like having constant deadlines. I like having the responsibility to like have a viewpoint on what's going on in the world, and I love my team there. So I'm gonna hang out there. There is talk of turning some of the 80s early chapters into a TV project. Wow. I am doing almost all of that talk. I should let you know. But there is talk. There is talk. So I'm going to try and launch a sort of television project.
There might be some investors in our audience. We'll have to talk to them a little bit later. The book is Party of One. Dave Holmes is the author. Thank you so much. I know you're going back to LA tomorrow, but thanks for taking the time to come by and join us today.
It was my pleasure.
I'm Steve Potter for St. Louis Public Radio, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is a presentation of St. Louis on the Air in partnership with Left Bank Books. This is St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Purple.